Okay, please let me introduce. Now the author, activist, journalist, bad dancer, also a veteran, a peace advocate. Oh, he led the Veterans March for Ron Paul. He's a voluntarist and anarcho-capitalist. Worked for RT. He started his own show, Adam versus the Man. He's been known to call out worthless statists like Tarpley and Jesse Benton, bullhorn overweight police, embarrass the directionless Occupy DC regulars, approach the TSA in his underwear, get arrested for almost smoking pot, and of course, loading a gun in the capital of the empire. Today's Tom Sawyer, Adam Kokesh. Welcome to have you on again.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, sir. Really appreciate it and the chance to share my story with you and your audience tonight.
I'm just glad you're free to do it even.
Hey, you know, if I was going to be in jail long enough, we would figure out a way to make this happen there too, you know, eventually by jail phone. We could make it happen.
Yeah, but I'm glad it's not by jail phone. I'm glad you're out. I mean, it was ridiculous to me. I mean, what you did was, no one got hurt or anything. It was a very well publicized, you know, widely announced event that you were going to go, what you were going to do. And then you basically loaded a gun and went home. And then a bunch of guys in costumes came and with arms and put you in a cage. And broke
it was a little
your
worse
door.
Than that. I mean, that would have been the nice, that's the nice, simple version of the story, man.
Yeah. But I mean, they could have guns. But it's just, it's weird. I mean, you're a soldier and an adult, and you loaded a gun. And it was clearly an act of civil disobedience and a political statement, and you weren't out to shoot anybody or anything. I mean, it was clear. I mean, you filmed it and stated that and stated where you're going to do before you even did it. And then they still came and threw you in a cage.
Well, the one point that I think has not been made in all of this, and you know, I'm really glad that the message of self-defense being a civil right got out to millions of people as a result of this. But yeah, if I didn't put out the video, I could have racked a shotgun 2 blocks from the White House and no one would have ever known. I could have done it right there on the sidewalk like I did, and the police would have been completely clueless. And it's just one more little point to underscore how much gun control doesn't work. But of course, you know that it's not about it working in the sense that we think of it in terms of the well-intentioned suckers that support it. It's about it being a mechanism of control. It's about keeping people down. The powers that be know that gun control leads to more crime. They know that it's a victim disarmament law. You know, they know that the real purpose is to be able to control people. And in my case, it was the excuse for my home to get raided by a SWAT team with an armored vehicle and 2 helicopters and a dozen police cars and, you know, all of
two
the other stuff that went along with that.
2 helicopters?
2 helicopters.
Wow, I wonder how much that cost to arrest you.
They sent more men after me than Bin Laden. Twice, actually. Once at the White House and once at my house for this. Yeah, your tax dollars at work.
I wonder how much that costs, seriously, for one night. I mean, and when they broke your door, did they even bother just trying to, I don't know, ring up and say, are you there? You know, like, were you even resisting?
This is where I feel really naive. You know, as someone who makes a living talking about these issues, you know, like, hello, of course they're going to look for an excuse to do a SWAT team raid on your home. Adam, what were you thinking? You know, I wouldn't have been surprised, at least at the time, like if they knocked on my door and said, hey, you're under arrest for suspicion of this. We're going to take you in. We're going to book you. We're going to release you. And you're going to have a trial. And that's what I was expecting. You know, that's what I was ready for. And instead, they, you know, it was effectively a no-knock raid. When they knock, police, open up, bang, and they knock the door down.
Was this in the middle of the night or –
it was about 8 p.m.,
okay, so.
And it lasted 5 hours. So they knocked the door down. They threw a flashbang grenade right in there. I mean, you would think, you know, flashbang grenade, you do as a response to something or there's some, you know, notion of hostility on
it's
part of.
It's usually like a diversion, so then they come in another way. But they're just like, no. We've got all these toys, damn it, let's use them.
Yes, exactly. And it went off right behind my dog, like, right under his butt. He was coming to the door to respond, right? And I'm so glad that they actually did this, because if they
it's
didn't,
good thing you didn't have a child.
Well, if my dog Baloo had not gotten hit with this flashbang grenade and been scared upstairs, they came in with another dog. He was getting hostile, you know, because he smelled him. They would have shot Baloo. And that's what they do in these things. Oh, you got a dog? That's a dangerous piece of property of yours that we can just do away with. So we're going to shoot the dog. I mean, you
just imagine if you had a daughter or something and they threw the grenade in there and it hit a person.
Well, I was like 10 feet away from that grenade when it went off. I was just like up the stairs coming down and, you know, went off in my face. It wasn't nearly as close to me as Baloo. Like for Baloo, it was literally at his hind feet where he was standing. You know, me, I was like 10 feet above it on the stairs, but I was in the room, got that percussive effect, and
could have fallen down the steps too.
Laser sights at my chest and all of that. Then my girlfriend at the time was visiting. She was on her period in the shower and was pulled out and was forced to sit in her own blood for 5 hours, well, 3 or 4 hours before they let her do anything about it. They had me sitting on the floor in the kitchen. I got roughed up a little bit. They ransacked the home. They stole my gun collection. They stole some silver. I don't know what else they took. But, you know, even all that, yeah, you know, I was then in the torture chamber in the Fairfax, Virginia jail for a while because I refused to cooperate with some things, you know, like, you know, asserting my rights. And so I was in a room where the lights were on 24 hours a day. I had shorts and a T-shirt, and it was too cold to sleep, and I was on a starvation diet of 3 sandwiches a day. And so that, you know, I realized they were, you know, I wasn't going to be able to do what I did when I got arrested in Philly for false assault charges and just, you know, play hardball and get them to release me. So, you know, I kind of gave in there, but I was in solitary for 2 more months before I got to general population. I lost 15 pounds and then I gained it back. But none of that was nearly as bad as getting stabbed in the back by the people that were working for me while I was in jail, and they stole my legal defense funds. You know, it was like they were trying to keep me in jail.
I was going to ask you about that because just from afar, and I'm in another country and I'm doing what I can, I was sticking up for you. And I caught a lot of crap just for doing that. I'm like, what's wrong with you people? And I guess you can really see who your friends are and aren't then when they just completely 180 when you're down. But the stealing your money.
Yeah. No, I'm referring to 3 specific people and one of them primarily. And it was like they wanted me to stay in jail so they could keep living off my business and enjoying my platform and doing my podcast. You know, they lied to me. They lied to the public in my name. And, you know, I made a lot of mistakes. And I've learned a lot of lessons the hard way. A lot of those were in how my business was set up and, you know, who I hired and why. And I had some bad endorsements. You know, I did some background checks on people that should have been more thorough. But I'm ready to move forward. You know, when I got out of jail, I didn't come home to a mess because I was homeless. They didn't pay the rent and got evicted and lied to me about why. And then they were supposed to put my stuff in storage, and about a third of it made it to storage. And it was in 6 different places. And I had to get someone else come in to kind of collect it all and get it back together. So, you know, I actually got, you know, I got released in November, but I haven't been able to really speak freely about this since then. And I just had my sentencing on Friday, on the 17th, a week ago. And
man, I was trying to get hold of you because I was going to say you can stay in my old house because I'm not there. You know, I'm in Japan. I was going to offer you my house until you got your stuff together, but I couldn't reach you. I mean, everybody was trying to reach you, I guess, but still there in the future if you ever have such a predicament.
Well, I might end up taking you up on that at some point because I'm staying with friends and, you know, I'm looking forward to moving to LA now and getting reestablished and relaunching. And, you know, before I say anything else, I really do got to thank everybody who supported me while I was in jail, you know, yourself included, because the public pressure that was brought had, you know, a really big role to play in the relative leniency of my sentencing once I took the plea. And, you know, I got bullied into a corner. I didn't want to take the plea. They were threatening to bring a bunch of other charges. They were threatening to have separate trials. Whereas if I didn't take the plea and once I'd been denied bail, it was essentially like I was getting sentenced before the trial just to sit in jail for, you know, what could have been a couple years before getting a verdict. But, you know, even that's like really not significant because there were two guys in jail while I was there who were falsely accused of rape, who were denied bail and sat in like no serious priors. They sat in jail for 10 months and then were found not guilty at trial. And, you know, they're never going to get that time back. You know, they're never going to get that part. One of them was an MMA fighter Oh, they both were. One of them was getting really successful in the prime of his career, just totally cut down. Hey, guess what? You're going to jail for 10 months because you're innocent. And I mean, that's just how the system works here. It's
no compensation afterward, or I mean,
no, there's no nothing. You don't get anything for that. Being government means never having to say you're sorry. And these you know, my whatever consequences I suffered, you know, for a righteous cause are really insignificant for the way that people suffer for just government evil and incompetence. But I heard a lawyer once say, "We don't have a criminal justice system, Adam. We have a legal system." And it's like, no, we have a criminal punishment system, because the system itself is criminal.
We and have it to generate money for the state
to
system.
Control people. Yes, to generate money. That's what it's all about. Because that's what government is all about. It's about
in a way. Like, I'm not saying you're lucky, but I mean you're less unlucky than the other guys, because at least you had a show and you had people who knew where you were going and everything. Those guys that got accused of rape, they're just sitting there with no one outside knowing what the hell happened and done.
Well, those guys were actually relatively lucky on that count too, because they had families that backed them up and they had some community behind them. But yeah, I got thousands of letters when I was in jail. People donated while I was in jail. And, you know, it sucks to admit that a lot of that money got stolen. Fortunately, we're expecting to get most of it back by reporting bank fraud. And it was a little over $20,000. Plus, you know, my landlord, when I got out, my landlord was suing me for $24,000 in damage that were done to the house. So I was able to handle that.
But cops did.
Well, some of it was that my employees did.
Oh, okay.
They left there. You know, it wasn't, I really, in that count, I think only a small portion of that could be even attributed to the cops. Although the door was part of it. When they broke the door down, yeah, I had to pay for the cops breaking my door down. Imagine that. Well, my landlord did, and I was liable, and then I had to pay him. But I'm
moving. You pay him twice, because you have to pay for the police, and then you have to pay for him to break your door.
Right, you're a double victim, because you're paying their salaries at the same time. You're paying them to violate your rights. So I'm just looking forward to apply all these lessons and applying them in relaunching the show, launching Adam versus the Man 4.0. And we're going to come back better and stronger as a 2-hour live show 5 days a week from Los Angeles. But I need the money to do it right. I'm not going to go off half-cocked again. I have to set aside civil disobedience as part of my activism for at least the 2 years of my probation. I'm okay with that. I want to focus on media production. I want to focus on getting out the book that I just finished the rough draft for, that I started writing while I was in jail, that I'm so excited about.
Is that Freedom? And the name?
Freedom. Yes. Yeah. All caps with an exclamation mark. And I finished the rough draft like the night before my sentencing, because I thought, well, if I go back to jail, I'll at least be able to manage the editing process and the publication process from jail, and we'll still get it released on Independence Day as planned. But fortunately, I get to build my platform to support it and to have Adam versus the Man going at the same time too. So,
do you have to read the title in the Mel Gibson voice?
No. But I will be reading it myself, so we're gonna have fun with it. And I got thousands of letters when I was in jail. And people who did media outreach, that just, you know, it was great that we got tons of local TV coverage, because they love that video, you know, just 22 seconds with me racking a shotgun in Freedom Plaza. Every time I went to court for every little thing, they would play it on local TV, and the other inmates of the jail would be like, "Hey, you were on TV today again. Thanks." So, but everybody who did media outreach, everybody who wrote letters to the judge, who left voicemails for the judge, you know, that was huge. And they know that there's that scrutiny there. And if they keep getting reminded, hey, these are victimless crimes, therefore they're not crimes. You're just screwing with a guy who's innocent, who didn't hurt anybody. He has no victims. You know, and I said in my statement at sentencing, I want to apologize to my victims. And my victims are the people who depend on park police for protection. I don't think anybody is thinking, oh, yeah, we're depend on these guys for protection. But it was a diversion of resources that I did not anticipate. And it wasted a lot of resources from the government's perspective that might have been used for productive things, at least not for destructive things. And so in that sense, you know, I had some unintended consequences of my activism that were genuinely regrettable. And I did not anticipate the cost to myself. But because I paid such a high price, we were able to have such a major impact. And like I said, we were able to reach millions of people, and that was huge.
Yeah, and people say, well, you could have been in there for 7 years or 2 years, but in my mind, the time served was already a ridiculous amount of punishment for basically nothing. I was just a theatrical, you know, act of civil disobedience about the Second Amendment. Of course, Second Amendment says we have the right to bear arms, except in all these places where you don't have the right to bear arms.
It's not about the Second Amendment. You know, I know this might sound like it's being kind of nitpicky, but it's if we use the statist language, if we use the government's words to defend our rights, then we've already lost. If we think that words on paper are going to defend us, then you know we're already giving up what is so much more important than that. This isn't about the Second Amendment. This isn't even about gun rights. It's about self-ownership. You as a free, beautiful, independent human being own yourself. And therefore it's morally wrong to initiate force against you. It's really that simple. That, you know, freedom is an absolute moral principle because a violation of freedom is to violate someone's rights. It is to commit an act of aggression against someone acting peacefully. And all of my activism, at least for the last several years, has been about that first and foremost. So it's not, you know, it's not about the Second Amendment. I mean, the Constitution is an anti-freedom document. It gives the power to a central authority to govern us. Human beings are not meant to be governed. And I don't just mean that, you know, it's an anti-freedom document in and of itself, which it is, but it was also a step backwards historically from the Articles of Confederation and create a much stronger central authority. The American Revolution was a major step forward for liberty in general, but the formation of governments after that, and I understand that maybe people at the time weren't truly ready for self-government, but the Constitution, compared to the Articles of Confederation, certainly was a step backwards, and we would have been a lot better off as a country, as a loose confederation of states, rather than as the Union, which is really the new, which is really the excuse for the new strong central government.
Yeah, I agree. Talk about emotional slavery.
Yeah, man, this was my epiphany when I was in jail, and
that's what happens. You have a lot of idle time. You get to think and philosophize.
Well, there was 3 weeks in the middle there when I was in solitary at the DC jail, when I didn't have anything to read, and I was cut off from the phones. Wait, I wasn't cut off from the phones. They just hadn't put my phone numbers into the system yet. You know, so there's 3 weeks. You know, I only and people didn't know where I was. So for a couple weeks, I didn't even get any mail, and that was really. Really kind of nuts. But I enjoyed my government-induced, taxpayer-funded spiritual retreat, and my forced meditation time was put to good use.
That's a nice and color for it.
I was, like, when I was in Fallujah, you know, I was in combat for 7 months with the Marines. I was always the guy that, even in the mornings when there were mortars landing all around us, like, I would wake up and be smiling and singing and laughing and telling jokes and, you know, just keeping everybody's spirits up. And, you know, if you can do that in that circumstance, you know, what does that tell you? You know, what does it tell you that some of the richest, most powerful people on the planet are totally miserable? And there's actually a specific scientific analysis of, you know, money buying happiness. Well, money buys happiness to the point that it buys autonomy, and there's a diminishing return there. And you look at the people who are behind statism. You know, look at the cops, look at the politicians, look at the banksters and the war profiteers and the powers that be behind the corporations. You think these are happy people?
Is it misery loves company? Is that what's wrong with these people?
Well, it's misery makes people want to victimize others. And a truly free person is someone who understands that they will never control what the world throws at them. They will never control their external circumstances as much as they want to. They will never even be able to completely master their animalistic reactions to stimuli. But their mood and their outlook and their attitude is always their choice. It is always your choice. This is the most beautiful part about being a human being, is that you have that fundamental freedom inside you. And governments want us to be afraid. They want us to be afraid of each other. They want us to be afraid of them. They want us to be afraid of people in other countries. And that fear, when you buy into that, is a form of emotional slavery. And it's not just about government. This is part of society that I think we're evolving past. As I see it, we are, you know, not necessarily in the traditional sense, but in a social sense and in an individual, spiritual, psychological sense, evolving past this kind of emotional servitude, this kind of emotional slavery, where we're trapped by the past and our past experiences and our conditioning, whether it's our parents or our communities or our governments or bullies on the playground, whatever it is. As soon as you give up that self-determination, that internal, emotional, psychological freedom, you're a slave. Not even to anybody else. You're a slave to your own thoughts, your own negativity. What's the point of being free if you don't know how to be happy? And we have this saying, right, from going back to Jefferson, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I think he got it out of order there. Because, yeah, if you're not alive, you can't have liberty and you can't have happiness. But
liberty is a product of happiness.
Exactly, exactly. Or you could say the internal freedom produces happiness, which is what leads to external liberty.
Have and you when read you Krishnamurti, you're sounding just like this Indian philosopher.
It's a fundamental truth that we can all figure out for ourselves. Yeah. And when you take on this attitude, you look at your oppressors differently. You know, you don't hate them. You don't resent them. You don't want to fight them or struggle against them. You want to pity them and love them and empower them. And it's a radically different attitude. And I think it goes a long way to causing a more free society when we empower those people to not be haters anymore. And it's just one of those fundamental truths of human existence that people will always try to deny. And just talking about this since I've gotten out of jail, people say, well, Adam, it's not that easy. No, that's the thing. It really is that easy. In fact, it's a lot easier than anything else. Anything else is accepting a life of hardship. You know, like it's much harder to accept emotional slavery and to live in fear and pain and discomfort and distress. Like, no, living happier, living deliberately, living well is easier. And it's not automatic. It takes a certain conscientious, I don't want to even say effort because that's not the right word for it, but a conscientious choice, a conscientious approach and an attitude towards life and towards living well that is true to this basic principle. But it's a choice that as soon as you realize it, as soon as you have the time to think about it, you can make right now.
Why do you think so many people miss that? And just, I mean, it seems like completely irrational to choose to be miserable, but people do it.
Yeah.
So why?
Well, there's a temptation and the psychological payoff for it. And it kind of goes to our nature as animals and the fact that animalistic reactions and negative emotions do serve a purpose. We want to know what pain feels like. If we didn't know what pain was, we wouldn't be able to avoid damage to our bodies, right? If we didn't know what hunger was, we wouldn't know the drive to be fulfilled. If we didn't have love, we wouldn't have the connectedness necessary for reproduction, perhaps. Although I think we'd manage regardless. But if we didn't have negative emotional responses to people that weren't acting well, then we'd have suffering as a consequence. But when you live in an age where you can master this, and maybe when we were in a state of nature, then these negative emotions served a very important purpose. And of course, obviously, as I said, they do today. But when we have the kind of profusion of wealth that we have today, where, I don't mean to diminish the problems of people that are starving on this planet, because they're real and there are lots of people that are hurting that way. But by and large, compared to where we were 2 million years ago, we're not scrambling to get by anymore, people. Like, we're past that point. More suffering is caused today, not for our lack of ability to feed ourselves, but for, poor social organization that results from these negative emotions dominating the way society is run and resources are distributed.
That's another interesting point you brought up, history. Just compared to people 100 years ago, 200 years ago, and so on. They weren't all miserable then either, and they didn't have cell phones and all the stuff we have, they didn't even have that 50 years ago. But if you go back to cowboy times or the Renaissance period or whatever, the level of happiness and depression or whatever might be even greater now than before. There seems to be more people with more psychological problems now, even though we have more stuff and more of abundance of wealth. And so they're definitely missing something there, and it's not exterior, it must be internal. And I think a lot of it is we've been very much divorced from philosophy and the things that we used to be engaged in a lot more, and and I guess caught up in consumerism and other things.
You make a great point. You could look at the world today and think that wealth causes misery. I mean, with America as a great example, although at this point, Americans aren't that well off anymore. And the slide downwards with all the recent trends of government's effects on the economy, you know, are making people really miserable in a lot of very real ways. But I believe that the human progression is one of two steps forward, one step backwards. And that happens on multiple planes, different levels, different areas, all simultaneously. For example, the founding of the Federal Reserve, 1913, start of a major step backwards that is with us today in a lot of ways and really could be described as responsible for all of the wars of the 20th century, at least all the major wars of the 20th century, that could be attributed as responsible for all of the major inequalities in wealth. I mean, obviously, you understand this, and I assume your audience understands that the Federal Reserve is a primary mechanism of transferring wealth from the poor to the rich, and it's still going strong right now.
As the World Bank and IMF, they put people in debt on purpose with oversized loans, and it's not businesses doing this. This is government. Governments get these gigantic loans, and then the whole populace has to pay for it. And it's not like these countries we call third world are just all full of people who are inept and lazy and don't know how to make things. It's not like that. It's just they don't have any money because it's been taken from them.
And they know their governments operate under the constant threat of if you don't cooperate, the American military goes in and replaces your leaders. So
sign here or die kind of thing. So
exactly. So I look at the bigger trends, the sort of longer term underlying trends of technology empowering people, of the raising of consciousness and awareness, and the general profusion of wealth. You know, some people say that the dollar's about to collapse. No, that's what's going to do it. You know, because human productivity is exponential and the printing of dollars is exponential. So that ripoff that it represents can keep going exponentially without a collapse as long as that underlying line of quality of life for the average sheeple, you know, keeps going up linearly. They can keep producing our purchasing power and our income. And just with technology, just with, you know, what we have with the internet, with computers, with smartphones, in a way, quality of life keeps going up for the average person, even if their relative purchasing power, at least in America, goes down. But you know, if you look at these underlying trends, humanity is always marching forward. We're always making progress. You know, like within this 100 years of the Federal Reserve, we've also had, you know, a gay rights movement and a civil rights movement and a women's rights movement. And look how far those have come. And I don't support the ways that those are entrenched in government, but what those represent in terms of achieving a freer society for everyone, a voluntary society, a more cooperative and less violent society, those are huge. Even with the Federal Reserve, even with the wars, as huge as they are, in terms of the sum of human relationships, they're really insignificant. And we are at the most peaceful point in human history in terms of you being least likely to be subject to violence from another human being. That's amazing. That's incredible. That is so much more important than the materialism that is screwed up by government, you know. And this is when you look at these deeper trends, if you will, or these more long-term trends,
I think the macro rise in humanities, but people get stuck on the micro and they go, well, we invaded Iraq. Well, we did and you know me too. It's completely horrible what all the things have been going on. But if you step back, as you say, and see, well, look, we had women's liberation. We had the integrating races. We had this. We're still going forward.
Absolutely. And I think if you really take an honest look at those underlying factors, it would be very hard to deny that we are on course to achieve a voluntary stateless society.
Well, I sure hope so.
Within our lifetimes. And, you know, we're young enough. We're gonna outlive the point where people die of old age, right? You've heard of the longevity escape velocity theory, right? You know, what we're coming to right now is the asymptote of human existence is, you know, all of these exponential growth curves. Of course, I know exponential growth curves never go vertical, but from the perspective of an individual, from the perspective of an individual human being, when you can't tell where the fastest computer on the planet is anymore, because they're just inventing themselves faster and faster. It might as well be vertical. When we get to the point where life expectancy is going up more than 1 year per year, and everybody essentially no longer dies of old age, it might as well be vertical. And this is, to me, it's very encouraging, but it also gives me that much more motivation to do what I do as an activist, as an author now, as a media producer, to make sure that when we get to that point, we get to bring as many people along as possible, make it as rich of an experience as possible, and we eliminate coercion as a means of settling disputes or organizing society by the time we get to that point. And we have to eliminate government. We have to eliminate organized force and coercion.
Adam Kukesh, the futurist.
Future freedomist.
Yes, well, and now your book is going to be released July 4th?
That's correct.
Okay, I just want to make sure that was a good date.
It'll be
something
the best
happen on that day?
Independence Day since the Declaration.
Oh, let's hope so. And I thank you for letting me have a sneak peek at it. I feel privileged.
Well, if I may share one more thing from the book, and you know, a lot of people who aren't familiar with these ideas might be at this point in the interview and go, okay, yeah, sounds great. Let's hope. Whatever. Crazy shit, right? That's way out there. And it is. I won't deny it. But I've also cracked the nut on how to get there. And this, I feel, is my one major legitimate intellectual contribution to libertarianism. And that's the idea of localization. A lot of libertarians get very frustrated when we get accused of not being compassionate. And it's a legitimate criticism, not because of the philosophy, though, because the philosophy is universal nonviolence. Like, hello, what could be more compassionate than that? You know, you own yourself as a free, beautiful, independent human being. When you get that, you understand that that's compassion. Then you go, how can they call me uncompassionate? Well, when you don't answer the question of how, or when you say, well, we're going to have a paradigm shift and the government's going to collapse, and everybody who's dependent on government goes, are you kidding me? You know, and we're all dependent on government to one degree or another. You know, let's be honest about that. It really is incompassionate to think, well, we're just going to pull the rug out from underneath everybody at some point. We're going to let the thing collapse. No.
A lot of it's
no.
The government helps you afford things it made unaffordable to begin with.
Yeah, right. And you understand that. But even you recognize, for the people that are on welfare, for the people whose jobs depend on government one way or another, they're completely dependent. And if we have the chance to have a peaceful, orderly transition versus a dangerous, violent collapse that's bad for us who get it, and all the preppers and all the survivalists who have a bunker, well, guess who the government is not going to be sparing in its violent death throes as it desperately clings to power? It's going to go after you who think you're the ones who've got it all figured out, who know how to survive the collapse. No, they're going to come after you first. They're going to let the sheeple cower in the cities, and they're going to go after you. But if we embrace localization, that is, taking governments apart from the top down. In the United States, we have a wonderful structure that allows us to do this through the electoral system and through the states. We can restore self-government incrementally. First, you restore it at the state level. People are more participating at the state level, then at the county level, then at the city level. Then you dissolve government entirely into private property collectives or into actual individual private property. And you can restore the community in ways that provides better mechanisms for taking care of people who are destitute. And we can fulfill the libertarian vision with a peaceful transition, not with a violent collapse, that actually will have the potential to create power vacuums that might be filled by worse governments. And we have an interest in making that transition smooth and peaceful. And this is why I'm running for president in 2020 on the platform of an orderly
solution. I was getting ready to ask the last one. So you really are going to run for president in 2020 then?
Yes. And my platform is an orderly, peaceful dissolution of the United States federal government.
Awesome. I mean, I will support you in that. I don't know if you'll be president, but I think just even running for president and getting the message out there, didactic or not, that's definitely going to be worth it, and it's going to help in this whole process.
Well, I'm pretty confident that in 2020,
I'll be able to win.
How much can the government screw up between now and then and make people want this, right? And the cool thing about it is, it doesn't matter if you're a liberal or a conservative or a mainstream statist, this is better for you too. If you feel like you need a leader, and by the way, if you need a leader, you're going to get a master and you'll deserve it. But if you want to lead yourself, you know, you're a lot better off with this kind of transition. But if you feel like you need a leader, if you feel like you need to be governed by the barrel of a gun, you're going to be better governed more locally. And everybody understands that. And my real goal, you know, I hope to be polling at 2 or 3% in 2020. And I know things are going to keep getting worse. I know this message is going to have more and more appeal. And maybe in 2024, I'm a real contender. And that's my goal. But really, I can be honest and say I'm not the best guy for this job. I'm not the one with the administrative skills or the bureaucratic management skills. You know, I'm just the one with the idea and the commitment to the message. And I'm going to run to win. And I'm going to be ready to carry out this plan. And if the American people decide that this is what they want and they're ready for it, then it really doesn't matter who's doing it. But I hope that by 2024 or maybe 2028, we've got a dozen candidates going, I am the best person for this job. And let me be the one to dismantle the American government. And I can go, you know, move to Hawaii and build an Earthship and retire at that point.
I think if you're not lying to people and you're not stealing, you don't need as many bureaucrats and it doesn't cost as much as what it usually does when you're not acting like that. I mean,
imagine that.
A few less dishonest politicians who have made it on a shoestring budget. And, well, guys like Ventura got elected and left with the surplus and spent less than a few $100,000 to become governor, while others spend millions. And the reason he could do that is he didn't have to pay everybody off.
Yeah.
So it costs a lot less to tell the truth than it does to lie. And so you don't have to meet these guys on the same playing field. All we need is to raise a fraction of what the competitors have, and you can compete.
Absolutely. And the book here is really going to be laying the groundwork for this. And in a way, it's going to be a test of how ready people are to hear this message. Localization is really the high point of the book, if you will. I mean, from my perspective, it's my favorite subchapter. And I'm going to be releasing the book this Independence Day. And I hope to be launching the presidential campaign next Independence Day. And that gives us 5 years, you know, to gear up from 2015 to 2020. So got a long-term plan here. I'll have my media platform well established by then. But, you know, as I said earlier, I'm really rebuilding from scratch. And I need people's help right now to get back on my feet, to get back to full production, to be able to do this right. And I know you appreciate this, and that's why you've had me on before. And you know, I appreciate your voice. And I look forward to having you back on my show on a regular basis when we get back up and we're having guests. But for people that want to support me right now, you know, please go to adamversustheman.com, make a donation. We've got a crowdfunder campaign there with a lot of really cool kickbacks and awesome ways to spread the message. But the best thing is going to be when we get up to full speed and we're able to promote the launch of this book and get something out that really has the potential to be the new scripture for the global freedom movement in a way that not just inspires self-ownership, but points the way forward in a very realistic and compassionate way. And like I said, it's very easy to read. It's very accessible. We've got translators lined up, volunteered to for enough languages to cover 90% of the population, including Esperanto. And we have one translator even who's going to put it into Klingon. So it'll be the first libertarian manifesto.
As if anybody can call him out on it.
Available for free online in every format possible. To an intergalactic audience.
Just in case.
Just in case.
Totally different question. Are you still training jiu-jitsu?
I haven't been able to, although there were some guys that wanted to when we were in jail. You can't really get away with that, especially when you're in solitary. but no, you can't do that when you're in jail. And I've actually really streamlined my fitness regimen because when I was in jail, we didn't have access to any weights. So I've just been doing calisthenics, and I've been very happy with it. It's much more efficient for me. And, I adjusted my diet, and I feel a lot healthier as a result. So I kind of have decided that I'm that much more committed to my work now. I really I'm glad that I figured out a way to be as healthy and fit as I want to be and maintain my muscle mass and my cardiovascular fitness. I run with my dog still. And I got a really simple routine where it's almost all body weight exercises.
Blue's doing okay after the flash grenade to the butt.
He's doing okay. He's a pretty resilient puppy. And
what kind of dog is it?
He's a Dane Pit mix.
Okay.
He's about 100 pounds now. And he keeps me motivated to run. And I'm really just focused on my work. You know, I'm doing a national tour. Hopefully in February. I got to deal with my probation officers still and see exactly what my restrictions are going to be and when I might have to report to California at a certain time. I'll find out about that on Monday. But I'm planning on doing a month-long national tour. And if anybody anywhere between Los Angeles and D.C. wants to host me for an event, please email me for that, adam@adamversustheman.com. But I've been getting lots of great invitations to go snowboarding and skiing in Colorado and go shooting in Kentucky and to go drinking in Texas and, you know, snorkeling in Hawaii. And it's like, you know what? Or scuba diving. It sounds awesome, but I don't need it, you know, and my work isn't work. It's more satisfying than any of that. And that's great. I don't mean to diminish people that enjoy things like that. You know, you deserve to be happy. Make your life suit yourself. For me, this is it. This is what I want to do. This is what I love. And I'm so happy doing what I'm doing. I feel like I can't spare a minute for anything else. So even the idea of like going to the gym to lift, it's like, well, wait, I can do my workout here and I'll have, you know, 20 more minutes to at least just communicate with people on Facebook or Twitter or answer some more emails or edit my book that much better, you know, or work on my website or make another YouTube video or whatever it is. Or spend more time with people like you having conversations like this, right? I find that so much more satisfying.
Last question for you, though.
All right.
When you come into Japan, man?
Oh, well, I might not be allowed.
You're not allowed to leave the
internationally,
country.
Yeah. I'm in prison America for the next 2 years. But if you can arrange for a speaking event.
Part of your probation for real? You can't leave the U.S.?
They said I might have to just successfully complete a couple months of probation before I get permission from the judge to travel internationally. But I've got a motion before the judge right now to make it explicit in my probation conditions that I can travel without restrictions for work. So if I'm getting paid to speak and it's, you know, for an event as opposed to for leisure, you know, I wouldn't want to take a vacation at this point anyway, then I should be able to do it eventually. Probably won't have to wait 2 years. But if I have to wait 2 years, yeah, it's the price you got to pay for doing this kind of work, but it's worth it.
Yeah, it'll still be here.
If it doesn't melt off into the ocean, right?
Yeah, well, that was a pretty bad accident. But, oh, well, I've eaten up a lot of your time, and I thanks for the conversation. It's always good to talk to you, and we have to do this more frequently.
Absolutely. And thanks for all the work that you do. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for supporting me while I was in jail. And, you know, it's just it's great to have people like you to be able to communicate with and to work with in this evolution of humanity.
No problem, man. I hate the state and police, so.
Don't hate. Don't hate, man.
You know what I mean.
Empowered.
What I really do dislike is that I actually feel sorry for them behaving the way they do because they're so miserable in their own lives.
Mm-hmm. That's it, man. That's it. That's the right attitude right there. Because then you can only help but reach out to them with love as fellow human beings and say, you're the ones that really need help. What can we do to help you?
They need a lot of it. Well, I look forward to reading your book, and I will see you in the future.
Thank you, sir.